You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 15th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Devin Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
We're recording a day early, back to our usual Wednesday recording, because Kara, you're going out of town this weekend. Where are you going?
I am. So this weekend, I am headed to Portland, Oregon for the Conference for the American Clinicians Academy on Medical Aid in Dying. It's actually called the National Clinicians Conference on Medical Aid in Dying. How very creative.
Sense.
Yeah. So, yeah, NACAMAID is going to be in Portland, Oregon this weekend. It's sponsored by the American Clinicians Academy on MAID and also Death with Dignity. And I'm going because, of course, I think I've mentioned on the show before, my dissertation topic is an existential. Do you guys want to know the actual title of my dissertation?
Yeah, sure.
It's kind of
absolutely
funny. It is Choice and Dignity in Death, an Existential Hermeneutic Phenomenological Inquiry into the Psychological Experience of Medical Aid in Dying.
What is hermeneutic?
Hermeneutic. I know that
Who's
word.
Hermeneutic?
Who's Herman? Hermeneutic?
I know. That's a great word.
It is a great word.
I
so hermeneutics is it's a discipline, it's a process, it's a methodology, but also a theory of interpreting text.
Yes.
So you'll often read about it with respect to like biblical texts or like old philosophical texts. So it comes from philosophy, but it's often applied in qualitative psychological research as well. So it's existential, hermeneutic, and phenomenological. These are just different approaches to doing a qualitative as opposed to a quantitative inquiry, which is something that I did not know existed before I started my PhD. Every study I've done in the past, my undergrad thesis, my master's thesis, any papers that I've ever been a co-author on, they were all quantitative, like classic quantitative science. This degree or this PhD thesis is very different for me. It's qualitative. So I'm not looking at population level data. I'm doing deep dives with individual people to try and get the gist, the qualia, the meat out of their experience. Because medical aid in dying is right now, it's just rare. It's only legal in 11 jurisdictions, like 10 states and DC, and just not that many people utilize it. So yes, there are some population level statistics. Like we can look at the data and go, this many people use it, and this many people who used it had this type of cancer. But to really get into the why of it all and how of it all, a qualitative investigation is a little bit more meaningful given the landscape. So that's what I'm doing.
Cool. That sounds awesome, Kara.
Yeah. I'm excited.
You want to know where I heard of hermeneutics?
Where?
One of my favorite super short stories by Ted Chiang, Catching Crumbs from the Table. It actually had to do with metahumans in human society that were creating these amazing inventions and discoveries, but they were so far advanced that they really couldn't explain the science to normal people. So normal scientists who were almost out of a job at that point because of all these discoveries that the metahumans were making, they created the hermeneutics, interpreting the scientific works of metahumans to try to understand what they can from these metahumans that were beyond comprehension. Fascinating short story. Highly, highly recommended. Very, very short, by the way, like 5-minute read.
And what a great use of that term.
Yes.
Like turning it on its ear, but also it's exactly what it is. I love that. Oh, and I didn't mention to you guys, we had mentioned before we started rolling. Next week, I am leaving to do a trip to the Middle East with a group of psychologists, postdocs, and trainees at the university where I am doing my internship right now. So we're going to be traveling to Jordan and spending some time in a university there to help train some students. We're going to be spending time in a shelter for women and children who are victims of violence. And then we're also going to be spending, I'm assuming the bulk of our time is going to be in a Syrian refugee camp. And we don't know yet about the influx of displaced individuals post
earthquake.
Yeah. So there may be, you know, obviously we just have to be kind of light on our feet and there may be some changes to our schedule. But we're going to be there mostly offering assessments and interventions, psychological assessments and interventions for these kind of sensitive populations because they just really don't get nearly enough mental health support. So yeah, I will tell you guys obviously all about it when I get back. And yeah. I think I will be missing one recording.
Right, right. Just
while I'm away.
So this is like Psychologists Without Borders, that sort of thing?
A little bit. Well, you know that Doctors Without Borders has a psychologist section.
Yeah.
And that my hope is that once I'm licensed, that's kind of one thing I would like to do with my career, is spend some time working for Doctors Without Borders.
Yeah, we'll definitely look forward to a full report when you get back.
Yeah.
Jay, you're going to start us off with a quickie. We're going to give a little bit of an update about all these UFOs the government is shooting down.
Boom, boom, boom. Like Space Invaders, right?
So as you guys know, UFOs have been in the news again. And oddly and sadly and with a huge head of frustration, they're growing in interest again, right?
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of things change in the last 20 years since the internet. And, you get a couple of air balloons up there and the next thing you know, the whole world is going nuts, like thinking that they're from another planet or whatever. So what has happened recently, if you haven't been reading the news, is that there was a Chinese balloon, they claimed that it was a weather balloon, but the U.S. claims that it was a spy balloon, and the U.S. shot it down. And then there were three other, we can't call them balloons, I'm calling them airships, three other things that the U.S. has recently shot down. So it's, people are talking about it, and there's been a lot of talk about whether or not these are alien spacecraft, for Christ's sake. Right? So what's going on here? So there's a little history behind actually the modern sentiment towards UFOs, UAPs, whatever the hell you want to call them. This goes back to a U.S. senator named Harry Reid about 15 years ago. Reid was very interested in UFOs, and he started allocating budget so the Pentagon would have more money to spend studying the quote-unquote issue.
Really?
Yeah, so that
is Harry Reid.
Yeah, Harry Reid's has been a long proponent of the extraterrestrial.
And it was from an extraterrestrial perspective, not like a we need military, like I'm very concerned, this is a.
It was kind of like a pet project of his. He was interested.
But he was interested because he thought they were
because
aliens.
Because of alien.
Not because this is a national
alien
security
visitation.
Issue.
Yes.
Okay. Right.
All right.
Yeah, good clarification. No, that's good. It was good. That's a good point. I didn't realize that it was unclear there. Yes, this guy seems to be a UFO nut. Okay, so in 2020, the U.S. Navy released several videos that showed footage of UAPs. You guys remember this? We talked about this on the show. UAP means unidentified anomalous phenomenon. So that happened in 2020. And then in 2021, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which is in the United States, released an assessment of the government's files on UAPs. And in short, this report didn't give the true believers the smoking gun that they wanted, causing even more suspicion that the U.S. government was hiding something. So there's this massive belief that the U.S. is hiding all of this proof. And, it's all coming out now, right, Steve?
Yeah, it's all coming out. I did hear an interview with someone who was representing the government, who said, about the three, not the Chinese spy balloon, but the three subsequent balloons that they shot down or whatever they are. Mm-hmm. They said that, we're still investigating it. At this point, we only know one thing. They're not aliens.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that she was willing to commit to.
So now you fast forward to today. The U.S. government, they shot down the Chinese spy balloon. They shot down these three other unidentified airships. And there's a lack of information from the government on all these things because, that's what they have to do, right? I mean, anybody that's reasonable isn't going to be like, how can they not tell us every single detail about all this stuff? Like, it's very likely that there's something sensitive when it comes to national security with all this stuff. So they're not going to come out given all their information, which is a ridiculous idea to begin with, because they're not being incredibly open about everything that there's any reason to think that probably the most unlikely thing that could happen in the world of physics would be an alien finding Earth, traveling to Earth, and then remarkably and ridiculously letting balloons. Is this the height of alien technology? Is balloon technology?
Right,
remarkable. Right, Bob? if they came here, they wouldn't be sending balloons into our atmosphere, guys. It would be something cool.
thing is, for the last 50 years or more, they've been saying that, Like, why haven't they revealed themselves to us? Well, they're biding their time. They're like, you know, softening us up and letting us get used to the idea for 50 years. But of course, they always think like they're just about to come out, you know, but it never, ever happens because they don't exist.
See the pattern?
Yeah.
See?
And as much as I would be horrified if aliens did visit the Earth, there would be something extraordinarily remarkable about it. And I can't say I'm against it. I don't know. I mean, I guess in the big scheme of things, I'd rather have it not happen because of the potential threat to the Earth.
Well, it would either be the best or worst thing that ever happened to us.
As Carl Sagan said, though, when it happens, you'll have no doubt about what is going on.
Right.
It will not be mistaken for a balloon.
No subtle
or
anal
blob
probes.
Squatch. Right. It's not going to be anything like that. It's going to be something more like maybe Independence Day, for example, in which you have these 15-mile-long ships
although they
overhead.
They won't be doing what those ships did because they was really
we
stupid.
We hope not.
Because it was stupid.
We hope not.
More like a rival, I would say.
And then, not that I want to talk about this schmuck, but Uri Geller like then opens up his mouth and is like, I can't even understand what his point
is. Is he still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive.
Right. But Jay, he is a self-professed UFO expert.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I know it. Yeah. Don't doubt what he says.
This is the psychic surgery guy, right?
Not psychic surgery.
The spoonbender.
Who is that?
And the metal bender.
The mediocre close-up magician who presents himself as a psychic.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we have here is a very interesting situation where there's a lot of hardware up in the sky. That's basically it. That's what we're dealing with.
Yeah. But the reports are that at any given moment, there are thousands of balloons, high altitude balloons with scientific experiments and, you know, other civilian stuff going on, as well as government stuff going on, but totally benign. At any given time, there's thousands up there. Right?
Not to mention the runaway party balloon, which does happen and does get mistaken as alien craft. McWest did a video recently on just that, in which this someone was shooting video out of someone on a commercial airline. So they traveled about 38,000 feet. They had their phone on. They were recording out the window. Something went zipping by. Oh my gosh, what was that at 38,000 feet? Well, Mick West and his people were able to basically analyze the video, and it was a party balloon. In fact, they found the website in which the sells that exact exact party balloon, happy graduation or whatever it said on it. So, but when you're up at that altitude and you're going that fast and something, you're passing something at those speeds, 400, 500 miles per hour, and it goes zipping by. Yeah, you could mistake something like that easily as some sort of alien craft that zipped by your plane.
Right, because when you hear hoofs, think aliens.
Come on. Did you guys
even these party balloons can get up to the altitudes, cruising altitudes for commercial planes, approaches not quite, but up to 40,000 feet.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kara, tell us about this male contraceptive.
Yes. Okay, so. Male contraceptives. This is quite a controversial. I don't know. Is it controversial? I'm curious. I want to poll you peoples. When was the last time that a male contraceptive hit the market?
You mean like a new invention, a new product?
12 years ago?
A new product?
That hit the market. That actually hit the market.
A decade ago.
Actually hit it.
Male contraceptive.
You mean the prophylactic, the condom?
Any kind.
Yes. Yes, Evan. It was the condom.
20 years?
No, the condom.
Oh, the condom's been around for thousands of years.
That was the last time?
Yeah, probably a couple hundred years ago, is when they started to be marketed.
Yeah,
I've read of multiple attempts, but I guess none of them
Multiple attempts, no successes. Yeah, so the condom, and what is the other option available to men?
Abstinence.
Vasectomy,
abstinence.
Which works very well, thank you.
The condom and vasectomy are basically the two options available to sperm-producing individuals to prevent pregnancy. So all of the contraceptive options that are not all, all but condoms and vasectomy are there for those with a uterus, right? So it's really incumbent on the individual who can get pregnant to take the steps to prevent the pregnancy. At least that's how the system has worked for a very, very long time. But of course, there are a lot of scientists who are interested in developing male contraceptives. And so before I talk about this new possibility that we may see on the horizon, which is the news article that I'm citing, I actually did a little bit of a dive into what else is in the works. And so there's some kind of interesting things that are being studied right now. Probably the most promising is a hormonal option that was developed, I think, at the University of Washington, and it's a gel. They said it's about the consistency of hand sanitizer. It's a clear gel.
Is it a spermicide?
No. It's to be rubbed on the shoulders.
Interesting. So it's topical.
It's a topical gel that actually, because it's a hormonal gel, it actually interrupts the signals, right, between the brain and the testes and basically reduces the sperm count. And once it gets it, you know, below a certain threshold, then pregnancy is no longer possible. Now, the problem, or maybe one of the downsides of an approach like this, is that you have to use it daily for, you know, a long period of time before it becomes effective.
You build it up, right?
Just like the pill, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just take the pill once. You have to take the pill every day. It's the only way it'll work. And so, but that looks like we're probably about, how long do you think we are from that probably hitting the market?
Well, a very long time.
Yeah, about 5 to 10 years.
What's the projected efficacy?
They're still working on the efficacy. They know that it's safe. They're working on the efficacy now. And so it's still in clinical trials. We're still, you know, far off target. What may actually come to market faster, though, is not a drug. It's a non-hormonal approach that's not technically a drug. It would technically be called a medical device. And FDA approval for medical devices is just faster than it is, you know, the process is faster than drug trials are. So it may be that even though this is less far along, it has the potential to hit the market sooner. And it's actually a hydrogel, kind of like a little plug that gets inserted into the vas deferens.
Yeah.
And it's sort of an alternative to vasectomy, because even though vasectomy is fast and cheap and relatively low risk, it's not always reversible. Whereas this hydrogel would be reversible.
Right.
So it'd be basically like plugging the vas deferens. Now sperm that's produced and kind of working its way out is going to be blocked before it gets to the urethra. And yeah, you know, that reduces the risk of pregnancy there. So that may make it to market before even the topical. There are also pills that are being developed, and there are injections that are being developed. Now, they all have their pluses and their minuses. Part of the reason, why do you guys think we don't have a male birth control?
Well, I would think that
because
men don't want to, you know,
don't want to limit their,
it's a selfish, selfish thing, you know?
Yeah, but what's selfish? Gene. Like, why? What about birth control would a man not want to use?
Yeah, they don't want to be inconvenienced.
So you think it's about a convenience, but do you think that's enough reason that something wouldn't have made it to market yet?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I would just think first that it would be a selfish thing, whether conscious or unconscious, by men.
Okay.
Or they've done research showing that 99.999% of men don't want anything to do with this.
Okay.
Something, you know, like a marketing or, you know, for economic reasons, right. It would never pay off.
That's a really open question still right now, actually. And then, Bob, I heard you, and I don't think you were trying to be punny, but what did you say in the background there?
It's hard.
It's difficult.
It's difficult. Yeah. It's difficult to develop a male birth control because they're very different systems. So individuals who produce sperm produce literally millions of them a day.
Mm-hmm.
And the testosterone cycle is just different. Individuals who produce eggs have a monthly cycle, and there's a window of ovulation, and there's also a window of the ability to ovulate. Like, physically, there are years in which those who produce eggs and ovulate, and after which they go through menopause, and they no longer can get pregnant. And also, let's talk about risk-benefit. And this is the part that actually peeves me a little bit, but I get it at the same time. who carries the highest risk when it comes to pregnancy?
What do you mean? Yeah,
women. I mean, wouldn't it be women?
Yeah, the person who's going to carry.
Yes, the egg.
Exactly. Carrier. So who carries the highest risk? The person who actually has a risk of potential harm or death from the pregnancy itself.
Sure.
Right? And the men or those producing sperm do not carry that risk, unfortunately. If you're looking at them as individual, discrete entities, the onus and the burden has always been on those who actually carry the child. And so the choices have always been on those who carry the child. But a lot of researchers are starting to say, we need to stop looking at individual people as discrete entities. And we need to start looking at couples as dyads. Because yes, the risk-benefit analysis, the bar has to be really high. Like, we're talking almost no side effects, because most men wouldn't put up with any side effects, because why take that risk if the benefit is not there, right? They're not carrying the child.
Right.
And so that's always been the calculus. But now a lot of researchers are calling for a more dyad-focused approach, that some of the risk-benefit that's being borne by the person producing sperm is to protect the person who carries the child, because it's a dyad now, as opposed to just looking at the individual. So lots to consider as I dive into this kind of newest flavor of what they're calling a male contraceptive. And they're actually calling it an on-demand male contraceptive. And that's why this is sort of really enticing. We are very far away from this ever potentially hitting the market. This has only been studied in mice. Okay, so keep that in mind. This is an experimental study. We have not even gone to human trials yet. But it's really cool. So this drug is actually, basically, it targets, there's an enzyme called soluble adenyl cyclase. And soluble adenyl cyclase is sort of like the signal that tells sperm to swim. So if it's blocked, the sperm stops swimming. And when sperm don't swim, sperm don't fertilize eggs. And they found that this worked when they gave it to the mice. It worked within 30 minutes to an hour, and it was 100% effective within the first 2 hours. And then the effectiveness starts to wane. I think it dropped down to 91 within hour three. And then after 24 hours, the sperm was completely normal again. So the hope here, right, and this is pie in the sky, because we have no idea if this is going to work in people. We have no idea if this is going to have all sorts of side effects. But the hope here is a single non-hormonal pill that works in under an hour and lasts 6 to 12 hours. And this has so many good things going for it if it works. Number one, as the person who has the potential to carry the child, you observe your sexual partner take the pill in front of you. It has that same thing that condoms have, where it's like, I don't need to trust that you've been doing this every day, because I just saw you do it and I know how it works. Right. So that's
huge.
And you
can't slyly not take the pill in mid-act.
Right, exactly. Like, I guess you could, but obviously it's going to really give that kind of sense of comfort to the partner. And also, it's fully reversible. In the mice so far, it doesn't seem to have long-term effects. They do know that men, like actual human men who are infertile, who had their adenyl cyclase enzyme switched off permanently as like a, I guess, a experimental treatment, they had an increased rate of kidney stones. But the researchers are like, yeah, but that was a permanent change to the enzyme. This is impermanent. It's only going to be when they take the pill. So they're not even all that concerned about that. But we're sort of jumping ahead, because we're still just talking about mice. They hope that they're going to hold human trials within 3 years. So we're still probably talking about a decade away from an actual product to be on the market. But if it can pass all of the steps, which is a huge, huge if, it's really interesting, this idea of an on-demand pill. And going back to what you were talking about, Evan, will men take this? I think they'd be much more likely to take this type of birth control. Yeah. Viagra is a big, big seller. And so I think pharmaceutical companies would actually bite, because it's also hard to get pharmaceutical companies interested in contraceptive products for those who produce sperm, because there is a big question of, are they even going to use it, and are they going to use it appropriately? Because, you know, we always talk about, even with birth control pills now, it's 90 whatever, 7% effective. when used as directed.
Right. Well, right.
You have to take it.
But isn't there a threshold? I mean, it's one thing to put on a condom. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to rub medicine onto you, you know, that's going to impact your hormones. Right. Mm-hmm. So these are two different things.
Wildly different. Absolutely.
And therefore, people, you know, a sperm-producing person might think, you know, maybe have some reservations about that.
Absolutely. Right. And I mean, it's so like cringy. And, you know, I find myself always having to bite my tongue as somebody who has been on birth control my entire life and dealt with the ridiculous side effects that can come from birth control, that it's just like a necessary evil that so many of us are willing to take. And then I have to remember it's because ultimately, sadly, biologically, we also carry the vast majority of the risk. But it mm-hmm. would be nice if we started to see that an appreciation of the fact that that risk is actually shared, and that those who produce sperm, their life is affected too.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, sadly, it's probably a little bit easier for them to issue responsibility in that situation, mm-hmm. but absolutely their life is affected too. And so, you know, kind of moving into that view of the dyad could be a new way to approach this problem. But hey, this on-demand pill sounds really cool. So fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Because I think just the more options available that are safe and effective, the better.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a complicated question, you know, in terms of why, but I think you hit upon one major reason is that since women are the ones who are at risk of getting pregnant, they need mm-hmm. to know, you know.
Absolutely. We need to know. And yeah. so it is really worrisome. Even if a guy told me that he had, I mean, not anymore because I don't have a uterus, but back in the day, even if a partner told me that he had a vasectomy, I might be more like, okay, I believe you, but maybe I would want to see the paperwork. But if he was like, yeah, I rub this gel on my shoulders every day. Don't worry, you can't get pregnant. I'd be like, uh-huh, you're still using a condom.
Well, because I mean, there are other reasons to use condoms
also there,
as well.
Yes, absolutely. There are other reasons to use condoms.
Disease,
I more
disease,
mean,
yeah. Navigation, yeah.
Whatever. I'm talking about a situation in which those reasons are less of a concern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just don't know if I would trust that a dude would do that.
Yeah,
every day.
But this solves
And there's no
problem.
Way for me to know.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
So, guys, I want to give you a bit of an update on wearing masks to prevent COVID.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. The question that seems to never go away. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm writing about this
so
because there was a recent Cochrane systematic review of blinded controlled trials, and they concluded that the evidence is not sufficient to conclude that masks work, right?
So the conclusion was inconclusive?
So no, you know, that's the way you have to state it. But they basically they basically said they don't work, right? And
or that we don't have enough evidence to say
couldn't.
That they work.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, right. What am I talking about? So this study, of course, has gone all over the right-wing media and is now the go-to link for all, you know, people on the anti-masker or masking skeptic side.
It's so
you
sad
want to
there's a
it.
Word for it, anti-masker.
Yeah. So I've had this link thrown at me a dozen times in the last couple of weeks, you know, just in the comments on various blog posts. But it's a good example of how to like evaluate a study to decide is what is this really saying? And, you know, how does this fit into the overall picture of the evidence? I think the most common way the study is misrepresented, and this has been by both journalists and commenters, as people, you know, in the street, is that it shows that mask mandates don't work. Actually didn't even look at the data on mask mandates. But you might be saying, but Steve, if masks don't work, how could mask mandates work? They're actually two completely different questions.
Right.
It's possible that masks work, but mandates don't. It's also possible that masks don't work, but mandates do, because it changes people's behavior in other ways.
Right.
Right. People who wear masks may also socially distance or be more not or avoid crowds, or they might think, oh, this means the epidemic is bad. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a mandate. So I better engage in this other, you know, good behavior. So that's why. But having said that, let's just back up a little bit and put this one study into perspective. So let's talk a little bit about the different kinds of evidence. If we're going to ask the question, do masks work? Specifically, do masks reduce the risk of contracting COVID-19? We could broaden that to, do they work to reduce the risk of catching respiratory viruses? we could focus that a little bit more and say respiratory viruses that spread through droplets versus aerosolized spread. So droplets would be the way COVID-19 spreads. We could look at just physically what's happening with masks. We could look at controlled studies. We could look at observational studies. We could look at epidemiological data, like population-based data. So let's look at these different kinds of evidence and see what we find. So first of all, does wearing a face mask reduce the spread of droplets and therefore the spread of viruses in people who are sick and are, you know, breathing and coughing and whatever? And the answer is clearly yes, right? So if we just look at, like, does it affect the droplet spread? The answer is yes. Surgical masks work better than cloth masks. N95 masks work better than surgical masks in terms of just reducing droplets. You know, the spray of droplets is much reduced. So just from a basic science plausibility perspective, it seems like it should reduce the risk of spreading, you know, infected droplets. Does it work to actually reduce the risk of contracting respiratory illnesses or COVID-19? Here, the data is mixed, and it depends on how you look at it. Why would it be mixed? Either it works or it doesn't work. Well, how do we define works in a research study? There has to be a statistically significant effect. And one of the ways that an effect size may be too small to reach statistical significance is that the thing that you're treating is too rare, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So, because there's only so much of an effect size to have. That's basically what, in my opinion, why like antidepressants clearly work for major depression, but it's hard to show that they work for mild to moderate depression.
I also think it's a function of there being heterogeneity in the population of people that we're trying to treat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But just on the, well, there's much less of an effect size to have. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you need many more people, much larger studies to reach statistical significance. So just, it's an artifact of just the baseline. Pre-COVID, and we talked about this interestingly, pre-COVID, the data on masks in the general population generally did not show statistical significance, because if you're just walking around the general population, your risk of catching a respiratory virus is so low, just that baseline, there's not much of a benefit to get from wearing a mask, and therefore it's hard to detect. Even if it was highly effective, you would need to do massive studies to show it statistically significantly.
Expensive, massive studies.
So that's one thing we have to think about. What was the risk of the population that they were studying? What was the baseline risk? If it was low, then that, you know, might obscure the effectiveness of the masks. We also have to ask, well, how are they determining whether the masks are effective or not? Meaning, you know, are they counting self-reported cases of the flu or COVID or whatever? Are they only doing laboratory confirmed cases? Are they using epidemiological data, population-based data to see like just like how many people are getting admitted to hospitals or are being diagnosed with it, right? What is their end point that they're using? And then you can ask, okay, well, are you tracking, are people wearing the masks properly? You know, if masks work when worn properly, but everyone's wearing it around their chin, then as a public health intervention, they don't work, right? So what are you trying to ask? Are you doing an intention to treat analysis where you're saying, what's the efficacy of telling people to wear a mask versus what's the efficacy of people actually wearing a mask properly? So because all these different studies are actually asking different questions and looking at different kinds of data, looking at the data in different ways, they come up with different answers. All right, so what kind of studies did this recent Cochrane review look at? So first, it looked at a very heterogeneous set of situations. A lot of times the studies were in hospital settings, some were in the general population, some were not during the pandemic, some were during other respiratory virus outbreaks, or not during COVID-19, some were of COVID-19. But they did restrict it to controlled interventions, which is good, but it also excludes a lot of data. Because a lot of the studies they included looked at situations where there was a low baseline risk of getting an illness, meaning it wasn't during a pandemic, they probably would not show a statistically significant effect. The lead author on the trial, by the way, is a guy who's basically already on record as being like dubious of mask wearing. Also dubious of the flu vaccine, this guy Tom Jefferson.
Wait, he's really worrisome.
Yeah, it's very worrisome.
So he had kind of a bit of an agenda going into it?
Not like the most objective guy to be put in charge of this review.
And the truth is, when you're doing a meta-analysis or like a huge systematic review, you can't blind yourself to it.
Right.
You can't. Like, you can't. There's going to be bias in how you interpret. Because when you do a systematic review or a meta-analysis, you are the arbiter of what goes into the analysis and what gets thrown out because the data is not good enough.
Yeah. And it certainly seemed like a lot of cherry picking to me, to be honest with you. I wrote about this on Science-Based Medicine, so you could go very deep into like the analysis of it. So it's really not a great study. It really didn't address the question. It didn't address the question of mandates. It really used a biased sampling, I think, of studies looking at ones where we don't expect masks to show a statistically significant effect. The only one they really looked at in a hospital setting where people would be at high risk compared surgical masks to N95s, but not to no mask, right?
What?
Right.
Why wouldn't that be tossed? Jeez.
Well, you could see why they wouldn't do that. Like, you wouldn't randomize people to not wearing any mask during a pandemic, but that's fine. But then you can't conclude that masks don't work because it could mean that the difference between a surgical mask and an N95 was not enough in order to see a statistically significant difference. Plus, we're talking about healthcare professionals who, let me tell you, are careful in other ways. You know, having been in a room with a patient with documented COVID, I could tell you we're damn careful, you know? And I managed to get through all of my inpatient service over 2 years without getting COVID from the hospital because of all the things that we do. And I could 100% see why it wouldn't make that much of a difference if you wore one kind of mask or another, although we always wore N95s. So this is like a typical thing, right? You obscure an effect because you're doing a lot of other things. It's like the healthy population effect, or you're basically minimizing your risk, or you're taking a whole bunch of other effective treatments. The one treatment you're trying to isolate is going to be diluted out. You're not going to see a statistically significant effect. So it really wasn't a great review. But it also did not look at all kinds of data, especially the kinds of data that show that masks do work. So, for example, let's look at the data on mask mandates, which is really what we're talking about here, right? We want to know, what should policies be around it. And the data there is actually among the most solid that mask mandates work because the United States alone, we have 50 states. That's 50 experiments, right? And you could compare a lot of data about states that like otherwise had similar populations or similar, exposures or whatever. And you could look, not only can you compare one state with a mandate to another one without a mandate, you can compare a state to itself pre and post mandate and also after lifting the mandate. So it's like multiple times over and over again, we get to see in multiple different states what happens when we initiate a mandate, what happens when we ease up the regulations. And there's a very clear signal that infection rates and hospitalizations plummet when you have a mask mandate in place, and they go back up when you remove it. And the data shows that pretty clearly, right? It's almost to the point of, well, who cares if it's the mask almost, because it's clearly...
Yeah, something's working. Let's keep doing that.
Policy works. We also have the fact that the flu basically went away for 2 years during the COVID pandemic, that whatever we were doing completely prevented the spread of the flu, like 99%, like the numbers dropped to almost flatline.
And then am I wrong, or did it come like roaring back?
It came roaring back.
Yeah.
Mainly because we lifted the restrictions. You know, people are not doing the things that we were doing during the pandemic, but also we lost 2 years of exposure. So we're a little bit more of a vulnerable population. So there was actually a rebound effect, but
a behavioral rebound effect too, where people got so tired of being smart and careful that now they're just like, not at all.
And if you look at population-based data, it also shows a pretty robust effect, about a 19% decrease in the reproduction number, the R number of spreading the virus around. So pretty robust data to show that masks work physically. They work at a population level. They work at a mandate level. especially when combined with like social distancing. And also, here's another thing. The review only looked at the person wearing the mask getting sick. It did not at all look at the effect of people who are sick wearing masks. But we know that it works both ways, and it's most effective when everyone's masked, including the spreader and the spreadee. But the data did not look at that at all. Mm. So again, it's another big hole in the data here.
I mean, that's like the general usage in most Asian countries.
Yeah,
like that's kind of, you know, obviously you don't want to get sick all the time. But you also, you know, wouldn't have a good quality of life if you had to wear a mask 24/7. So to be safe, when you're sick, wear a mask.
Yeah, definitely
or
when you're sick,
stay home.
When you're sick,
don't go to the office.
Isolate and wear a mask. Absolutely. Yeah. When you're in crowds, it's also during a pandemic, it's also a good idea to wear a mask, or during flu season or whatever. If you're a vulnerable population, you should be more aggressive in wearing a mask and distancing. So I think if you look at all the data, not just this one crappy review, which really isn't a very good review and is very narrow in its the way it was looking at the data and its conclusions, it doesn't show that masks don't work. But I think what we can conclude if you look at all the data is that wearing a mask when you're in public during a high risk of spread reduces the risk of getting a respiratory virus and of spreading a respiratory virus if you're somebody who's carrying. Also, during a pandemic of a respiratory virus, mask mandates are an effective public health measure. That's a pretty clear thing. And if you look at all the data, I think that there is a dose response curve where N95 masks work the best, and cloth masks, not so much, surgical masks, somewhere in the middle. But the most important thing is how you're wearing the mask. It has to cover your nose and the mouth, and it has to have a good fit, assuming it's like the kind of mask that's a mask that's effective in preventing droplet spread at all, right? So it can't just be like this wispy cloth mask. It has to be a good mask, and you've got to wear it properly, especially when you combine it with social distancing. It's extremely effective. But of course, the ASCII the anti-maskers now have their Cochrane review that they could point to make their dubious claims, which they are all over the internet now, which is unfortunate. And it's like it takes you this long to explain why it doesn't say what they say it's saying.
Right.
So what do you say when someone throws a link at you and you don't want to spend 20 minutes explaining?
Well, now I just link to my science-based medicine article.
That's science-based medicine, baby. Yeah. Go there. I go there. It's one of my first go-tos when it comes to these kinds of questions.
I have a one-sentence reply and a link. It's partly why I wrote it, because I wanted to just have it there, you know. But it's tricky. And of course, you know, a lot of people email me. You go, how do I, you know if this study is legitimate or not? It's tricky. It's hard. You know,
that is a fair question.
It's not easy. There's no one simple trick to know if it's good or not. There's a bunch of red flags you could look at, but you have to have a basic working knowledge of how evidence works, how scientific evidence works.
And just because something's Cochrane, it's not necessarily.
There's a lot
perfect.
Of crap. A lot
Lancet,
of crap comes out of the Cochrane reviews.
Lancet, you know, we've seen problems with that. We've seen it happens everywhere. So you can't just go by the publication.
It's such a hard thing about reading complicated scientific literature. Mm-hmm. Is at a certain point, you have to kind of have done the work to be a scientist to be able to read complicated scientific literature.
Defer and that's
to
almost consensus. Every right. Mm-hmm. And therefore, almost everybody is non-qualified, and you have to defer to the experts.
Right.
Like there is a certain point where, unfortunately, we have to say, like, how do you? You know, these are some tools and tricks, but ultimately, what is the, you know, the gold standard? Have the skill to read the article.
Right.
Which you're never going to be able to do because you spent your entire career training for something else.
No way.
And even experts can get it wrong if they have a bias, because you can say, where do you set your threshold of evidence? You could always arbitrarily set it higher and think, I'm just requiring good evidence, evidentiary standards. But if you are biased in where you set that standard, you could make anything seem negative, because everything's always relative. Right?
Which is why it's also so important to have a good understanding of philosophy, not just science.
That's true.
Yeah.
Good point.
And Kira. Be aware of your own biases.
All right, Bob, tell us about this rogue black hole tearing through the universe.
So what do you call
what?
What do you call a supermassive black hole combined with Steve's co-hosts?
Rogue black hole.
Supermassive.
Supermassive black hole. Black hole.
Which is what astronomers have likely discovered because it seems to be creating stars in its wake as it rushes away from its former home galaxy. This is from researchers from Canada, Australia, and the USA, specifically Peter Van Dockham, professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Steve, tell him I said hi.
Will do.
Supermassive black holes. We've talked about them before. They're among the most massive black holes in existence, from hundreds of thousands to billions of times the mass of our sun, with potential event horizons rivaling the scale of our solar system. Truly magnificent things. You may hear the term ultramassive black holes. Some astronomers use that to refer to black holes greater than 5 billion, although it's not, you know, it's not standard, but I think it should be because I like.
Is there an uber massive black hole?
No, there isn't.
Not yet.
But ultra would be nice if that came into wide use. So supermassive black holes, they're commonly found domiciled at the centers of galaxies, right? That's pretty much where you always hear of them. But there are scenarios that could allow them to be unceremoniously ejected, elevating themselves to rogue status. And this can happen in multiple ways, but all of those ways start with a galaxy merger. And these happen all the time, right? I mean, our very own Milky Way has undergone at least 5 major mergers in history that we can detect. Sure, there have been more. All right, so we're talking about merging galaxies to start off this talk. About rogue supermassive black holes. So where's the fun in two merging galaxies? It's really not in the stars. It's really the real action, right? The real action happens when the two central black holes come close enough during the merger to start their ever-shrinking orbital dance, right? That dance releases gravitational waves, which are stolen from their angular and their linear momentum, drawing them ever closer and closer, ending in a merger, right? And that merger emits the now famous and distinctive chirp that our gravitational wave detectors can now see. Did you know that this orbit and merging process can also result in what's called a black hole kick? Ever hear of a black hole kick? I had
no.
Or it's also called the gravitational radiation recoil. Fascinating. That can happen when two black holes that merge, they have certain asymmetries. Say for like mass is one example that can cause the gravitational radiation that's released to be in a preferred direction, right? And acting like a rocket of sorts. And that could fairly easily cause a newly merged black hole to reach escape velocity from a low mass globular cluster, right? If you look at these globular clusters, a lot of them don't have central black holes. This may be the reason why they don't, but they're low mass and it's kind of relatively easy to be ejected. Very rarely something happens it's a black hole kick, but it's called a super kick. And it's a much more energetic one, as you could imagine. And that could cause a supermassive black hole to get this 5,000 kilometers per second is how fast it could eject. A supermassive black hole. I mean, this isn't like a planet. This is like a supermassive black hole traveling like, oh, I'm going to start going at 5,000 kilometers per second. Thank you. Like flying out of having enough escape velocity to escape a large galaxy, becoming a rogue. So how cool is that?
It depends. Is that thing going to destroy us? That's not cool.
Oh, yeah. We're dead. But the thing is, as cool as that is, and I wanted to go into a little detail because that's so fascinating, that's very rare. The most likely cause of a rogue supermassive black hole is probably the same binary pair that are merging and doing their dance, but sometimes they orbit each other so long, it could be a billion years potentially, right? It becomes a threesome when another galaxy, yet another galaxy merger happens. And then you have three supermassive black holes in orbit. And these three body interactions, you know, they're obviously fun, right? But sometimes, you know, one of them gets jealous and the next thing you know, one of them is hightailing it out of the galaxy at high velocity to become a rogue supermassive black hole. That's how they think it happens most often. Okay. So then how do you detect one of these guys? It's not easy.
Stars.
It's not easy. But if you're ejected from a galaxy, you know, what's really around you? You're not going to have, you know, all these stars zipping around you like we're there at the center. So it's not easy to detect them, but it's doable. One way is to see its interaction with the CGM. Now, it's a new initialism for you, CGM, and it does not stand for computer-generated meatballs. It stands for circumgalactic medium.
Ooh,
which
I
don't remember coming across that before. Circumgalactic medium, and that's the area that immediately surrounds a galaxy. There's the diffuse gas that's between the stars just doesn't end at the edge of the apparent galaxy, right? It doesn't end right there. It slowly thins out, like Earth's atmosphere. It slowly thins out. So you can have a huge area around a galaxy that's about 200 times more dense than the truly extragalactic space that's farther out, much farther out. So you've got this dense but hard to detect area. And so what the researchers found from the Hubble Space Telescope images was essentially an unidentified linear feature in this CGM. It's a line, basically. So they hypothesized that this line or linear feature could be the wake of a rogue black hole that was essentially plowing through the relatively dense ionized gas in this circumgalactic medium. All right. So you got that. It's ejected from the galaxy. It's going through this circumgalactic medium and it's creating a wake. It's so massive that it's creating a wake even within this relatively, you know, kind of diffuse gas. It's creating a wake behind it that's detected as this linear feature, this line within the CGM. So that's what they detected. But, you know, detecting a linear feature in a Hubble space image isn't very persuasive in and of itself. So, of course, you had to look deeper. So they looked for another feature that their models predict in the wake. And one of those, and what's predicted was these knots of shocked gas that can cool and form stars. So this gas is plowed into, and within the wake itself, you can have these areas that are of shocked gas that kind of just cools down and is changed in some ways so that it can cool and form stars. So not only when they looked, not only did they find these star knots, which I love that word. I think I made it up myself, but I may have come across it. So they found these star knots, but not only that, they were the right age and they had the right metallicity, and even the dust quantities that they detected were all expected. When they went to their models and they determined what should they have, they were pretty much, you know, right around where they needed to be. So fairly, you know, more than fairly convincing. That's pretty convincing. But of course, they wanted to be even more confident. So they realized that they would have to look back at the galaxy itself. And they realized that if a supermassive black hole was ejected at high velocity from the center of a galaxy, there should be detectable morphological changes within the galaxy, right? It's going to leave a path. It's going to have some effect. And when they looked at the galaxy, that's exactly what they found. They found these weird patterns and things happened to the galaxy that could have been happened by a supermassive black hole being ejected. It kind of made sense. So, what else was left for them to do? Well, one other thing that all good scientists should do is you look at other possible explanations, and they looked at them. For example, black hole jets could potentially cause some of what they're seeing. Black hole jets could cause shocked gas in the CGM, and it could also create stars. But they looked at that and they ruled out the jets. There were many, many reasons why the black hole jets couldn't explain what they were seeing. So a black hole, a rogue black hole interpretation fits the observations better than anything else. So in the future, what are they going to do in the future? Now it's interesting advance, an interesting paper, but it's not perfect, right? What could make it better? What could make this better is to prove this rogue supermassive black hole theory is unambiguous evidence of the black hole itself. Because they, in all of this stuff I've talked about, they never found the smoking gun. Oh, there's the actual supermassive black hole itself. And if they did find it, that would pretty much lay to rest. I mean, it would be like, yep, this is it. They found a rogue supermassive black hole. This is fairly definitive at this point, even though I think they're quite certain now. But I think they would definitely be maximally certain if they found that. And that would be really cool because, a rogue billion solar mass black hole cruising through space, giving birth to stars in its wake, it's just kind of awesome, and I want these things to be real. So I hope they are.
Okay, but not too close to us. You know?
No, we're safe. Yeah. That would be cool, though, if in any of the mergers that the Milky Way had, that we had another supermassive black hole that was ejected. And imagine if we found it at some point, like, oh, well, look over there. There's a supermassive black hole that was probably ejected from the Milky Way. That would have been cool. But I think most of our mergers have been with dwarf galaxies, so I don't think they would have exceptionally huge supermassive black holes. But still, it would be cool.
I wonder what percentage of the intergalactic stars were formed intergalactically by things like that versus just ejected from galaxies.
Wow.
Well, I mean, they couldn't get too far away because once you're outside the CGM, though, then there probably wouldn't be enough of the gas available to cause a wake that would form into those star knots. I think you'd have to be within the CGM to make that happen. Extragalactic stars, right? That's what you're talking about.
Yeah,
they're just probably just rogue stars, right? That were ejected.
Yeah, that was always my encounter.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy. So as predicted, an unbelievable amount of people emailed me to give me the almost completely correct answer of what this noise is. There's little details in there that most people don't know. I didn't know it before I researched this. So Evil Eye sends in, he says, the original emergency alert system tone when it had a different name. So that is not correct, but
I could see why he would say that, though.
I could, too. I thought about it, and I definitely... You know, it's almost, for some reason, this sound is like saying, you know, flood, tornado, you know what I mean? It has like an emergency kind of ring to it, but that is not correct. Another listener named Bonnie Jean wrote in and said, that's the sound dial-up internet made when it was connecting. I could see why you would think that, but that is also not correct. So I'm going to go right to the winner now because I just, like I said, like everybody and their dog got this one correct in one way or the other. So let me give you the winning entry. The winning entry was sent in by a listener named Chris. And Chris said, isn't that the noise the computer speaker used to make when your mobile phone went off near it?
Yes. That's exactly right. So
interference, right.
Yeah. To explain what Chris is saying. So in the early version of cell phones, like we're talking about like versions 1 and 2, I believe the clamshell one was a popular phone at the time, or the Nokia, like that little Nokia phone.
Yeah. The original flip phone.
Yeah. The Nokia that I'm referring to isn't the flip phone, but it's basically those first small phones that we had. And, you know, compared to what we have today, they were complete garbage. So what would happen is before a text or the phone rang, this noise would be heard. And what that is it's actually quite interesting. So I got a wonderful explanation from a listener named Michael Robluski. And Michael said, hi, everyone. This is my first time answering. As a guy in his 40s, this brings back mixed memories. This answer comes courtesy from my dad, Nick, who spent the majority of his career working with mobile phones based stations in Australia. I may have misinterpreted some parts of the explanation, so that's on me. So here's his explanation. Essentially, this noisy occurs when a mobile phone is measuring the signal strengths and handing it off to different base stations while determining the best base station to connect to. While searching for the strongest available signal, the phone making the call tries to push through competing signals, starting at maximum power before making a connection, then reducing it to a level that still carries a stable connection. This is why we hear and felt the pulsing or that noise that I played. The sound from the noisy are commonly associated with the old GSM network. Subsequent networks still operate in the same way, but at much higher frequencies, so we don't notice it occurring. In essence, you know, back in, I mean, what were we talking about here, guys? Like the early 2000s? 2007-ish, I think, when we all had these early versions of cell phones in our hands.
Even the 90s, you know, late 90s. Mm.
I think the thing that needed to happen, though, was you needed to be near something that had a speaker. Right. The noise didn't happen over the phone. It would come through whatever like speaker you had. And at that time, if you remember, a lot of us had computer speakers. You know, I don't have a computer speaker anymore. I have right? headphones and I have more advanced gear than what we were using almost 20 years ago. Yeah. And then you would hear that pulsing noise come through the speaker of your monitor speaker or the speakers that you have on your desk or even on your TV. You know, it just depends on what was around that could pick up that extra strong pulse signal that was being sent to establish a connection. So very interesting. There's a lot of science behind this. It's not just, your cell phone making noise. Like there's a really interesting explanation behind the whole thing, which I found to be kind of fun. I never knew what the hell it was. Just kind of took it for granted. And then when it suddenly went away, right? Like all of a sudden that sound is not a part of our landscape anymore. And we all kind of just forgot about it. Those of us who did hear it back in the day, who had phones back then.
Hmm.
So sounds come and go.
They do, like the dial-up baud, you know, connector, the modem connector from what 1994. That whole sound.
Yeah, oh the gosh. Late 90s. Yeah, that I mean, sound.
Yeah, ask someone who's 20 years old today to tell us what that sound is. They won't know.
Yeah. You know, and I forgot to say the guy's name last week that sent in the noisy. That was sent in by Jeffrey Toon. Thank you, Jeffrey. Very cool noise. Thanks for the reminiscing sound. I have a new sound for you guys this week. The noisy for this week was sent in by a listener named Phil Wyman. If you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something cool, somebody out there heard something cool somewhere, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve.
Yes.
So after much discussion among the SGU crew, we have picked a date for a very interesting show that we are doing. And this show is for our patrons. The first hour of this show is going to be specifically just for our patrons. Where we will do patron secret stuff that only the patrons will know. And then the next 5 hours will be open to the public. This is a live streaming event. It's not quite an endurance show that like we've done in the past. We've done 24 hours. We've done 12
no
hours.
Sweat.
This is going to be a 6-hour live stream.
Yes.
And the bulk of the material that will be in this live stream is going to be offbeat stuff that the SGU is doing. It's not going to be, you know, us talking about what we typically talk about, which are news items and things like that. We will be recording one podcast during that 6-hour time period. All the other stuff that we do is going to be other stuff that you may not have heard us do before or discussions that you've never had us have. It'll be a lot more like the Friday live stream, except more on rails. You know, we'll have things more mapped out and you know, we'll have bits that we've created and things like that. So we're writing the show right now. We absolutely are going to have some guests, which I am not ready to announce, but things are in the works.
I'm going to eat a ghost pepper.
Oh my
and then,
God.
And then cry.
Evan, yeah. I love you too much to let you ever do that. I saw a video of a guy do that.
Yeah. Oh,
and
no.
And he almost – he looked like he was being dehydrated from the inside.
Well, Evan, you said it. Now you got to do it. You can't tease the audience
like
that.
Oh, God. Don't ever eat those things.
I will
Why
eat what appears to be a ghost pepper.
Oh, nice.
Made from real cherry candies.
Evan, you will not be eating a ghost pepper in front of me in the same room. I don't want to be near a human when they go through that.
You'll have sympathetic burning pain for the person going through that.
I'll be in excruciating mental anguish watching someone do what. Oh God, it's terrible. I don't know.
Can't
why
even think about
it.
Forget
about it.
But the point is, you're going to see things that are special, unique.
Yeah, yeah. We'll do some fun stuff.
Yeah,
we'll do some wacky stuff, and we want to make people laugh and just have fun. And so, I'm really looking forward to it. So the date is going to be May 20th. May 20th will start somewhere around 11 a.m. Eastern time, just so people from different time zones will have a chance to tune in. All of these things are unlikely to change, but if they do, we'll let you know. So May 20th, starting 11 a.m. Eastern time, we will be doing a 6-hour show. Remember, the first hour will be patron only. If you're interested, then become a patron, and you can join us for that first hour.
Thank you, Jay. All right, guys. Well, we have a great interview coming up with Richard Wiseman, so let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Professor Richard Wiseman. Richard, welcome back to the ESGU.
A pleasure. Always a pleasure to be here.
Yay, Richard's here.
Yay!
We're going to chat about a bunch of stuff, but we are having you on now because of your latest book, which I believe you published under the nom de plume of Dickie Wise. Is that correct?
Dickie Wise is my new name. Yes, that's right. I'll be doing all of my future books under
Dickie Wise.
We should tell folks. Yeah. So an MC once said to me, do you mind how you introduced? I said no. They said, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dickie Wise. And I walked onto the sound of my own footsteps and walked off to the sound of my own footsteps, actually. Yeah. And so after that, whenever someone says, Ed, do you mind how you're introduced? I've always actually looked quite closely at what they're going to say about me because of the Dickie Wise incident.
They thought they were being funny.
Yeah, they were being quite funny in the sense that they enjoyed it, and at least two people in the audience laughed.
Okay, well, that would beat their expectations.
Right. And the problem is, those two or three people in the audience that knew me, I have become Dickie Wise to them, and this was a couple of years ago, and I will always be Dickie Wise. So even now, I'm regretting telling you this. The next Skeptics Conference, I'm going to be Dickie Wise, aren't I?
Yeah, what were you thinking of telling us?
I know. I'm this naive fool.
Richard, I promise never to call you Dickie Wise.
But behind my back, I will always be Dickie Wise.
I make no such promises. So the book is called Hocus Pocus. It does say Professor Richard Wiseman presents Hocus Pocus, Magic, Mystery, and the Mind. And it's a comic series, very lovely illustrations. And each story tells the story of a historical magician or alleged psychic or medium or whatever, and sort of gives you a behind-the-scenes look at what they were actually doing.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it was a lovely sort of lockdown project. Worked with Jordan Culver and Rick Werther, these really sort of talented comic book artists. And I was just trying to find a new way of doing skepticism. And I'd seen their work. They're incredible at bringing something to life. And of course, with comics, it's wonderfully visual. But also you can travel through time. You can travel from one place to another. And so we sat down. We created five issues, one of them around ghosts, another around prophecy and so on. And then we had our favorite stories like, you know, Haunting of Bawley Rectory or seances and so on. And we just found a way of making that work within the comic book genre. And then someone's been kind enough, Vanishing Ink, a magic publisher, has been kind enough to put them all together in a single volume. So very excited about it.
Yeah, it's a really pretty book.
Thank you.
I like the illustrations. And obviously there are skeptical lessons in each story. You learn about how the Fox sisters were cracking their toes.
And the law of large numbers is in there when we get to sort of acts of prophecy, and it's interactive magic tricks as well. And it really just was that thing of, I don't think there's been a skeptical comic before. And, you know, when I was a kid, certainly, I wasn't a fan of reading. I absolutely hated going to libraries and reading. But I loved comics. And so this sort of visual way of bringing skepticism alive, and it isn't just for kids. I mean, it works for adults as well. Mm-hmm. So that's what really got me excited. We do need to find new ways of doing skepticism, I think.
Now, do you see this as the target audience being a younger audience for this, or you think this could cut across?
I think it cuts across. I mean, they've been published separately as comics, and adults have bought them and enjoyed them. But also, I think it is the sort of thing that you'd give to, you know, I guess sort of 12 upwards, something like that. And it doesn't pull punches in terms of the skepticism and the factual content. It's all in there. And I think it's very well researched. So far, no one's managed to find a factual error. But it is that notion of, you know, there's a massive audience for graphic novels, and there's not a community that's very well served by skepticism. There's a lot of supernatural, ghosty, believerish stuff. And we thought, let's try and redress the balance and get out there and say, you know what? Some of the skeptical stories about some of the tricks of the trade and how we kid ourselves, actually, they're just as exciting as the you know, this is the spooky stuff.
Yeah, it's a good medium for explaining a lot of the stuff that goes on, because, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. It's easier to show than to tell a lot of the... like what's happening on stage and, you know, how some of these tricks work.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, if you have got people that are happier with visual images, and I'm like that, I think visually in meetings, I never write a single word in a piece of paper. You know, everything is always little scribbled notes and doodles and so on. I think it just appeals to that, and it's because it's full color. It feels quite kind of graphic, as it were. And it is that when you work with comic book people, they just have a different way of telling stories, because, as I say, they can zoom through time, or they can suddenly zoom up on a particular detail, or we can see a pair of eyes and see the person sweating or whatever it is. So it was a very, very different way of storytelling, at least the way I was used to. So it was a fun project to work on.
So is this the first time that you've done a full book that was illustrated with? I mean, no paragraphs? Is it just all comics straight through?
So it was originally done as five separate comics, which we did really in the UK. And then they put together a single book. And it is a graphic novel. We do put an introduction in there. And I think there's probably one page of explanatory notes and there's reading at the back. But no. It's wall to wall graphic. It's a comic.
So you've done lots of – you've done a lot of books, and we've done just a couple. So how – can you describe the things that make it its own beast? Because now it's completely different. How is it different? Describe what – was anything shocking when you went through the process? Like, wow, this is different than I anticipated. What was it like?
It's a good question. It's that visual element. So I'm like, you know, you folks, I'm just used to writing paragraphs and describing a situation. And Jordan and Rick don't think like that. So if you're kind of saying, let's look at the psychic horse, you know, J.B. Ryan famously tested a horse that he thought was psychic. Well, you know, Jordan instantly said, okay, we start from a distance. We see a farmhouse. We zoom in, we zoom in, we zoom in. Now we see the horse. And of course, you don't do that when you write. You don't kind of go, look at the distance, a farmhouse there, and now we're zooming. You know. So it's boom, 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 and now we're with the horse. And then we turn to one side, and there's J.B. Ryan with some ESP cards. And now the horse starts to talk, because in their world, animals can talk. There's no problem with doing that. And then once J.B. Ryan is debunked, we zoom in on his eyes, and we see the kind of fear in there. So it's just a different language. And in fact, when it came to representing magic, it was fascinating because they would do it in snapshots. And those are exactly the snapshots that magicians try to sear into your mind. So you've got a box, you show it empty, you click your fingers, something appears. The three key snapshots are empty box, clicking fingers, something appearing. And they instantly got that visual language that magicians use to make those tricks work. That I think what you're looking at is how we represent strips of activity in the mind. I think we do it primarily visually. We don't do it verbally. And it's just these key, like keyframes in a film. And then we fill in the rest of the story in between. So it actually became really interesting psychologically.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, stage magic is obviously visual. I mean, you may be talking to the audience to put ideas in their head, but mainly it's a visual medium. And so that it does translate very well to the page.
Yeah, I think that's so, you know, magicians want you to forget certain parts of the narrative, and they do that by making those parts seem unimportant. And that's done visually. So you know, if you're going to show a box empty, you do it in this showy way and this kind of dramatic pose. And then closing up that box is done quickly in a way which it's forgotten about, because that might be where the action is on the magic trick. And so as I was working with them, yeah, you just realize, oh, I see. Okay, this is how you folks think. And we put lots of interactives in there. So, you know, there's a darkroom seance, but when you shine a flashlight through the page, you see the tricks that reveal the seance tricks. There's lots of interactives where the character can actually predict the future or predict your choice and so on. So it's all the things that we can't do with the written word. So it's a really interesting project to work on.
Richard, are you in the book? Like, are you drawn in the book as a narrator?
Yes. Yeah. That often you need a little voice, and I start out each. So there are five comics in here. Each one deals with a topic. So it might be ghosts or seances, prophecy, and levitation. And each of them start with me opening a folder, a sort of top secret folder from the House of Mystery. And then some notes fall out and we go and explore the stories from that. So I'm the sort of linking character. And they did make me look about 150 years old. So that was nice. So it's full of in-jokes as well in terms of magic and skepticism in there with all cameo roles and so on. So it's, It's just entirely different to doing the sorts of books that you folks and I'm used to, which is very, well, print-based, you know, and different way of looking at the world.
So has Netflix called you yet to retain the rights for this so they can make a miniseries?
They have signed up Dickie Wise. No, not yet.
But, well, because they've done that with other comics and other things. They've translated them into these series.
It would be great. I mean, it's kind of astonishing to think that I don't think there's been a skeptical comic before now, and skeptics are a fairly innovative lot. So yeah, it's just nice to explore that genre and that medium and to take the material, the Fox Sisters, Bawley Rectory, whatever it is, J.B. Ryan and so on, Nostradamus, and just translate it into this very different visual form, which I hope will bring in you know, new folks into the movement.
Richard, let's talk about what else is going on. So what else have you been up to after getting this book out?
I've been up to lots. I have a new podcast called Richard Wiseman's On Your Mind, which is a psychology-based podcast, a weekly. Mm-hmm. And we are putting out the first episodes about lying. Then we looked at laughter. And the one that came out today was about sleep. So different psychological topics. And unlike you, folks, I hadn't done a podcast before, mm-hmm. so it was kind of fun to work out how that worked. So I've been chatting with science journalist Marnie Chesterton, who's quite a well-known science journalist in the UK, and we just banter. We try to have fun, and we try to do it all in about 25 minutes. It's harder than you folks make it sound very easy, but there's quite a lot going on with it, isn't it, to make it interesting and mm-hmm. give it legs and so on. So, yeah, that's been another big project I've been involved in.
Great. Yeah, as you will discover if you keep it up, it's a lot of work, you know, to keep it going.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a very saturated marketplace now, so.
Yeah, I did realize that. I mean, it's kind of everything I know about psychology being put out there with a few stories. So, and that's been, that's been nice. And we hit the number one science slot over here when the first episodes came out. So that was very nice.
Each one's a single topic episode?
Single topic, absolutely. Yeah, and I can't remember what order they're in now, but there is ghosts in there. There's magic in there. There's going to be ESP. We haven't recorded that one yet. So there's some skeptical topics, but mostly, you know, it's the sort of self-development stuff. It's motivation, persuasion, all those sorts of things. So it's been fun to sit there and talk about stuff and then realize that it's wrong and then have to go back and re-record it, which has been primarily my experience is realize that, you know, you're halfway through a story and think, actually, I don't think that's right. Can I just check that journal article? It's been good. So I've been doing that. And then what else has been happening? I had a strange experience, actually, the other day. I went down to London, and I'm a creature of habit when I'm in London. So I normally arrive very late in the evening, and I always go and buy a pint of milk. So I've got milk the next morning when I wake up for my coffee. So I did that. I wake up the next morning. I unscrew the top of the milk. And I don't know what it's like in America, but in the UK, we have a kind of seal on mm-hmm. the milk. And I looked, and it was gone. And about a third of the pint was down. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I didn't check when I bought this from the supermarket. I think someone's been in the supermarket drinking the milk. And I thought, I'm going to be a good citizen, because that does occasionally happen over here. I'm going to be a good citizen. I'm going to go round and tell the manager that I think somebody has been drinking their milk. So mm-hmm. I went round to the supermarket. I asked to see the manager. They're walking towards me. It's about 9:30 in the morning. And it's then I remember that I had a bowl of cereal the night before.
Oh, my God.
Yes, of course.
So I'm standing there with a pint of milk. The manager is walking towards
half me. A pint of milk.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, less than a pint of milk. Two-thirds maximally of a pint of milk. Manager's walking towards me. And I thought, it's moments like this of being a psychologist and a quick-thinking magician will save the situation.
Right.
Yeah. So I turned around and walked out.
You covered, kind of covered your head. You know,
sorry, never mind.
Yeah, I said, don't worry, nothing. And so I just walked out. But yeah, so it's just showing it's very easy to trip yourself up, I find. Particularly you arrive at a place in around about midnight and quite sleepy when you have your bowl of cereal. So I think there's a lesson there for all of us.
Sure.
I'm just not certain what it is.
Mm-hmm. You were sleep eating. Oh my
God. Sleep eating. So my life continues to be a catalogue of weird experiences mm-hmm. of my own making.
Yeah, but seriously, I mean, you know, having... you know, spoken to a lot of people who are true believers and a lot of paranormal stuff, that's the level of evidence they bring. Because they would say a ghost drank their milk. What's the other explanation?
And
are you sure you didn't drink the milk? I don't remember drinking the milk. And I bought it. They would give you a whole story building a case for why ghosts drank their milk. And that's the level of evidence.
Yeah, or if you're... Yeah, yes. Or if you're in Iceland or something, an elf did it, or yeah. a troll came yes. in and did it. Right, so it's culturally based.
I would be open to either of those explanations, as opposed to me drinking the milk and just forgotten about it the next morning. But no, you're right. There was a whole load of things that the Society for Psychical Research did called jots, which is when you're looking for an object and you can't find it in your house, like your car keys, and then you turn around and they're somewhere really obvious, like on the kitchen mm-hmm. table, and you can't believe you didn't see them. And they started to look at this as a paranormal experience. And I just think it's an interesting psychological experience, because I think we've all had that notion of looking everywhere. Oh, my goodness, they were right in front of me. So I think there's something interesting psychologically going on there. And sometimes with skepticism, you know, we throw the baby out with the bathwater, that we just go, oh, you know, there's an obvious explanation. But some of the psychology behind this stuff is I think, quite interesting. And sometimes it comes from parapsychology. You know, when you think back of inattentional blindness, you know, the famous gorilla mm-hmm. and basketball yeah. clip, that originated in a 1950s experiment within the parapsychology, where somebody dressed up as a ghost in a white sheet ran around and right. no one noticed them. And it was
clever.
Yeah, it was years before then that became a topic within psychology. So, you know, I think there's some interesting stuff to unpack within the parapsychology, even if it's not psychic or supernatural.
Yeah, they certainly get involved with a lot of that kind of phenomena in their research, because they're looking for anomalies. Anomalies are, I think, have a psychological neuroscientific explanation. So they actually end up documenting a lot of interesting, you know, psychological phenomena, but they didn't recognize it as such. Like with that study, the ghost walking through the quad of a university, they didn't go from there. They just know, that's odd. Nobody noticed my fake ghost walking through, you know, this highly populated area. But because they weren't, they're not neuroscientists, or they're not thinking in that way, they missed it. They missed the very interesting phenomena. It had to be rediscovered later by a psychologist.
Absolutely. So it's Tony Cornell that did it. And yeah. I knew Tony very well. He's no longer with us, unfortunately. But and so you're absolutely right. What Tony was interested in was, if ghosts are around so much, because you know, he believed in this stuff to some extent, if ghosts are around, why is no one reporting them? So he went out and dressed up as one. And then his explanation was, well, actually, we're just not noticing them. And you are right. He doesn't look at the psychology of it. To him, that's kind of yeah. case closed. So it is interesting. But time and again, you do get these. I think because they work on the fringes and they're working with anomalies, actually something very innovative bubbles up there, and it gets just overlooked. And it's probably sitting in all those parapsychology journals, if anyone cares to go through them.
Yeah, I think the same is true of like the UFO phenomenon as well. They're mm-hmm. not aliens. But it is an interesting phenomenon. You know, it's interesting that so many people can be seeing things that they can't identify. And it tells you a lot about perception, you know, and about the way we construct perception. It's just a different lesson than the one that they're interested in. But it is interesting that the true believers end up documenting most of the raw data, because they're like tireless in cataloging whatever the anomaly is.
It is interesting. So if you look at the Barnum effect, these kind of very general personality statements, the original work on that was done in the 40s. And what many people don't know is that in that study, they gave these general personality statements to people, and they said, give them how accurate are these? And everyone said 7 or 8 out of 10. A few weeks later, they got that group back, and they said to them, they told them exactly how the study worked. These were all general statements. Everyone endorses them. And they said to them, can you remember what number you gave them? And people misremembered. They said, I only said 4 or 5 out of 10. And that is the first documented evidence of what's called the hindsight bias, that we misremember what we said in the original time around in order to look better later on. But again, it completely gets passed over in the literature. And it's not until the 70s that you get biases and the hindsight bias come back, that suddenly that becomes a massive, massive topic. So, yeah, I think, you know, skeptics have done a lot of that work. You know, there's a lot of pioneering work to be done.
Mm-hmm. But I do think skeptics can be at the nexus there, because, like, we are trying to find scientific explanations for the anomalies that the true believers are documenting. And, yeah, you could be a lazy skeptic and just write it off. But if you are trying to like find a really good explanation for it that sort of leads you to often to like neuroscientific explanations.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look at the early eyewitness testimony mm-hmm. stuff. It was Hodgson and Davy, 1880-something. They were doing the very first eyewitness testimony experiments. And that was all on seance phenomena. So they're getting people to come to fake seances. And they were then publishing these fantastical accounts of things that never occurred. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, yeah. I think it's quite a rich scene to sort of look for phenomena which, as psychologists, we haven't perhaps recognized yet, but are sitting out there. I don't know how we got onto this. I think we started with the milk incident.
Mm-hmm, we did.
It all derived from
the milk incident.
That yes. horribly embarrassing episode.
That's right.
But Richard, to continue with the milk thing.
Yes.
you did go into the supermarket yes. with the milk, right?
Yes, correct. Yes.
So what did you do with the milk after you left the supermarket?
Oh, good question.
I consumed the milk. Mm-hmm. with a slightly confused mindset and I was sort of thinking, right, that's that. I how did that happen? And I know what it is. I would say a creature of habit. I normally don't touch the milk. It was very late when I got in and I wasn't mindful eating, should we say. I was just kind of woofing down the cereal. So, yeah, I consumed the evidence that obviously was an embarrassment to me. And I've never been able to look at a pint of milk again.
Yeah.
It's such a terrible, terrible experience.
A sour experience, yes.
Yes, yeah, but it was embarrassing. It's got to be said. Could have been worse.
Yeah, you broke your routine, yes. And sometimes that's enough.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it was more than enough in this instance. So, yeah, it was. That's one of the most interesting things that's happened to me, such as my life, over the last couple of months.
Yes. The Dickie Wise milk incident, we'll call that.
If in 50 years' time somebody discovers that this is a major psychological phenomenon, I want that to yes. be the name of it, the Dickie
Wise.
Oh,
the Dickie Wise effect?
That's right. Yeah, when undergraduates are doing research into this, they go, oh, it's the Dickie Wise effect. So, yes, you heard it first here, folks.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
He wrote that. Yes, he wrote that comic book. Who's Richard Wiseman? I want to read Dickie Wise.
Okay, Richard. I mean, this was a lot of fun. Again, I've enjoyed the book. It's on my coffee table. Thank you for the copy. It's very lovely. You could buy this.
So you can buy it on Vanishing Ink is the American publisher. Yep. In fact, it's the publisher, Magic Publisher. But they will ship all over the world, and that's the only place to get
Got
it.
You.
So, yeah, Vanishing Ink. Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you could see about the comics on Hocus Pocus Comic. Squarespace. You're actually using Squarespace.
Oh. We're using Squarespace. Yeah, and I think actually if you look at Vanishing Ink, they've got lots of the videos there and people can see how beautiful it is. So, yeah. But that's been a lot of fun. It's now, what time is it here? My goodness, it's 20 to 1.
Oh, boy.
Time for milk.
Time for milk. Time for mindless milk. Yes. And then the morning, I'll be furious. Yes. So, thank you. Thank you for keeping me awake. And it's always
good catching up with you, Richard. Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week. Bob, I think you're going to like the theme. The theme is death.
Whoa.
Just death.
Just like that, huh?
That's it.
Thanatos.
All right, here we go. Item number one. The 6-foot standard for grave depth dates to 1665 when the Lord Mayor of London ordered all graves to be dug at least 6 feet deep as an anti-plague measure. Item number two. The term mortician was invented by the funeral industry in 1895 to replace Undertaker based on a contest in Embalmer's Monthly. And item number three, Lincoln was the first public figure in the U.S. to be embalmed and is responsible for the popularity of this process, which is now mandated, with exceptions, in 48 states. Evan, go first.
Oh, boy. This is good, Steve. I like this. 6-foot standard for grave depth. Okay, 1665, the Lord Mayor of London ordered all graves to be dug at least 6 feet deep. Well, Okay. It doesn't make it a standard, but that's fine. Anti-plague measure. You know, I don't know about this one. At first, I know nothing about this particular one. Never heard this before. That means nothing. I get that. But I would have thought the depth had to do with, you know, the natural sort of disturbances that occur at above the 6 foot line. Like there's less going on, or to do with the temperature or something at 6 feet, rather than, you know, some English person making a proclamation that sort of just caught on. Anti-plague measure. I mean, didn't they burn those bodies and stuff if they thought they had plague? They threw them in the plague pit and lit it on fire. So I don't know about that one. Then the term mortician was invented by the funeral industry. This I kind of believe. The only thing weird about this, a contest in Embalmers Monthly. Oh, clearly it was a quarterly, not a monthly. I mean, it that one's too funny in a morbid way to...
If they did that today, they would be called Death McDeathface.
Yeah, exactly, right? Oh, gosh, the funeral industry. I believe that one's right. Lincoln. All right, was he the first public figure in the U.S. to be embalmed? Perhaps that could be right and responsible for the popularity of the process. Well, Lincoln was, you know, just an enormous figure in history, and certainly at that time that was going on, mandated with exceptions in 48 states. I guess I'll go with my instinct. I don't think that first one about the Lord Mayor of London is correct. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
All right, the first one here about the burying people at 6 feet, you know, it's a standard, and you're saying that it dates back to 1665, when they decided that it should be done because of the plague. It's an anti-plague measure. That makes a lot of sense. I thought it had to do with grave robbing. And then wouldn't animals also dig up the bodies if they were like a foot deep? You know what I mean? Like,
that's what I mentioned. I said disturbances, right? That occur at above the 6 foot mark.
I mean, I suppose that the 6 foot standard could have started with the plague. The second one about the term mortician being invented by the funeral industry. I mean, I could see that too. I mean, you know, branding is a big deal. Undertaker is definitely a lot more dark than the word mortician. Bob, do you have a preference between the two?
Yeah. I mean, if I were going for a creepy vibe, you're right. I would go with Undertaker.
Yeah. Contested on Bobber's Monthly.
Really? I know that.
It's so awesome. Like, I want that to be true. I want that to be so true. It's so cool. And then the last one, Lincoln was the first public figure in the U.S. to be embalmed. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. And I see no reason to think why that wouldn't be true. I mean, so, okay, you know, just because of Embalmers Monthly, I got to say that one's a fiction.
Wow. Interesting.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, these are all interesting. Nothing is obvious here. So I'm just going to kind of roll with it. The grave depth, 6 feet. Yeah, I mean, sure, that's possible. I mean, that seems to be going back more than I would like, though, 1665. I would guess it would be, you know, the standard, at least in the United States. I mean, I don't know what the standard is anywhere else, or even how much of a standard it really is. And 6 feet, I dug a grave last October in my graveyard.
Oh, in your grave? Okay.
And screw that. 6 feet? 6 feet? I was lucky I made down 2 feet. It was so hard. So, wow. 6 feet, yeah, is ridiculous.
6 feet, 3 feet wide. Yeah,
if the ground is rocky,
and
it's,
6 feet
that's
long.
That's hours of work.
Right. You see people in a movie digging a grave, la, la, la. All right, 6 feet. No. There's no la, la, la about digging a grave. Holy crap.
They have a machine for that now called the backhoe.
Yeah. Okay, so we go to the third one. Lincoln. Yeah, first one embalmed. Sure, I guess. I mean, that's no red flags there. The second one, though, mortician and undertaker, this made me think of Return of the Living Dead. Awesome character. Great. One of my favorite zombie movies. It was like the first fast zombies that I can remember. Send more paramedics. But they had an undertaker mortician dude. I don't know the actor's name. He was fantastic. Loved him to death. He made the comment that there's not a lot of book learning for morticians. It's more of a passed on thing. You know, you are mentored, and that's where you're going to learn a lot of your techniques.
Your
and
trade.
Sure, what do I, you know, using a zombie movie
as it's definitive in any way is ridiculous. But I don't care. I'm just going to roll with it because all of these seem possible. And Embalmers Monthly, come on, that's just ridiculous. I mean, that's every month. Here's more information on embalming. That's what really was really, and that's why the mortician in Return of the Living Dead would be like, no, there's no Embalmers Monthly. I would teach you, not some stupid monthly thing. So fiction, number two.
Okay, and Kara.
Yeah, I weirdly know a lot about death. Obviously, this is, mm-hmm. I have two journals in front of me right now. I have Death Studies, which I read regularly, and I have Omega, the Journal of Death and Dying. This is like my academic area, and I actually have a friend who's a mortician who I've interviewed multiple times on my podcast. So I can say that I feel very strongly that Lincoln was the first public figure in the U.S. to be embalmed.
Cool.
I also feel, the reason I feel this very strongly is because modern embalming in the U.S. is an invention of the Civil War. It did not exist prior to the Civil War in the U.S. And so that timeline makes sense, which also kind of makes sense with the mortician thing. The funeral industry is very strong. It's very powerful. And it basically cropped up around the Civil War. And so it sort of makes sense that the word mortician would be a sales tactic to me. I would not be surprised. And I don't know what you were talking about, Bob, with this. It's true. Like historically, yes, there's a lot of like, you know, family and institutional knowledge that gets passed down. But most people who actually are full morticians, like they have degrees in mortuary science.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah. I know that.
I'm like, it's an actual thing you can study.
I wanted to give
school.
A shout out to the movie.
Who's that woman on YouTube?
Yeah, who does Caitlin Doty. I've interviewed her.
Yes,
like Caitlin.
Yeah, she's
times.
Very, very good.
Yeah, she's, yeah. Check out Talk Nerdy. There's a bunch of interviews with her. I think that the one that's bugging me, the one that feels very wives' tale-y to me, is the Lord Mayor of London one, the 1665 6-foot standard. I bet you that's like, there are so many different examples of 6 feet, like all over the place in literature. I don't know. That one bugs me. That one just feels like it's anachronistic or just like silly. I don't know. I don't think it's true. So I'm going to say that's the fiction.
I feel 100% better about my choice. Right?
I could be wrong, but that one just feels the least.
That's okay.
Like,
if we're wrong, I'd rather be wrong together with someone.
Right.
Than be wrong. So, it is different.
So Kara, you don't get the journal Dying Monthly?
It's no, but I do get Death Studies, which by the way is quarterly.
Death Quarterly?
See? That's what I said.
Yeah, right. Death Studies is quarterly.
All right. Well, you all agree on number three, so we'll start there. Lincoln was the first public figure in the U.S. to be embalmed and is responsible for the popularity of this process, which is now mandated with exceptions in 48 states. You all think this one is science, and this one is the second week in a row that I swear
no!
to. This
no!
Fiction.
No way.
No, it's
yes,
not.
Yes, it is the fiction.
No, it's not.
Which one is the fiction?
The third one. The one that you all thought was
oh,
science.
The one he just interesting. Read. Okay, so who was the first public figure to be
so that part was correct.
Oh.
What's incorrect.
Well, no, the popularity of the process is just, it's the funeral industry, it's the war.
The part that is the fiction is that it's not mandated in any state and that funeral directors, as they're now called, have to tell you that embalming is completely voluntary.
I know that's true, and I didn't even notice that that was part of it.
Yeah, okay, a little bit of a distraction there with the Lincoln part.
Yeah, I know that that's true. I've talked about this publicly. Like, bodies are quasi-property. You do not have to get embalmed. There are places where you have to, where you can't do a green burial. There are places where you have to be in a sealed casket.
The only regulation, because this is all state by state in the United States, but the only regulation is for bodies that are crossing state lines.
Yeah, there's transportation.
And that's only with some of the states. Some, it's not even federal. Some states require that if you're going to ship a body out of the state or into the state, that it has to be embalmed.
And even that doesn't make sense because they don't pose a risk.
Yeah, they don't.
Like, yeah, embalming doesn't do anything.
And there are regulations about burial, but they where you can bury them and whether or not a funeral director has to be involved. But they mostly involve people who have an infection, died of something contagious.
Well, and also what you can be buried in. I know in California, for example, there's only like a handful of places where you can have a, quote, green burial.
Yeah.
Where you're like in wicker or in no casket at all.
Right.
It's really stupid.
But no states just straight up mandate it.
Yeah, and I fucking knew that too. And I just didn't even read that part of it.
Oh, you could have grabbed the whole glory this week to yourself.
It's a three-parter, and two of it are correct.
Yep, but not the big one. All right. Which means that the six-foot standard for grave depth dates to 1665, when the Lord Mayor of London ordered all graves to be dug at least 6 feet deep as an anti-plague measure. That is science. Every piece of that is correct. This is something now. Exactly where 6 feet comes from, nobody knows. Like, why 6 feet? There's a lot of theories about why 6 feet. It was just, I think, as deep as you could plausibly dig. I didn't expect to get an anecdote about grave digging from Bob during this segment, but apparently we did. But you're correct,
Bob. You made a confession.
You are correct that it is really hard to dig 6 feet down, which is why, even today, that's rarely done. The most of the states that regulate it will allow, they think they want like at least 2 feet of dirt over the casket. And if the casket's 2 feet, so that's 4 feet. So that's really the minimum. But the whole 6 feet under, like 6 feet being the standard depth of graves, comes from this edict. And it was a bunch of anti-plague measures. This was one of them. They thought it would reduce the miasma, you know, coming from the bodies and causing the bubonic plague. Even though they didn't, you know, once they were buried, even at 2 feet, you know, there was no risk of spreading the disease at
that
point.
What about in the water? Like, where's the water?
I thought they burned those.
I know.
Yeah, they probably did burn a lot. Remember, there were multiple.
Is there not a risk of burying a plague body if it gets in the water?
And wasn't burial reserved for, like, wealthy individuals? Like, people did, you know, paupers' graves and stuff. You know, they didn't care about 6 feet or 2 feet or whatever.
Oh, yeah. That's why it had to be mandated, because people were not otherwise doing it. It would be really expensive to hire people to dig a hole that deep.
Super expensive.
Yeah, because it's hard, as Bob was saying. So it's none of those depths are enough to get into the water table, which is 20, 30 feet deep. So it's not an issue. An extra 2 feet doesn't matter. It really was just the miasma thing about the plague. That was the only reason why they did that. And again, we're not really sure why they chose 6 feet, but that's what they came up with.
Weren't most of the bodies that are, I could be wrong, but in the catacombs in Paris, weren't most of those plague bodies?
So remember, there were multiple waves of the plague. It wasn't one event.
Yeah.
And this was towards the end of the waves, you know, that was hitting London.
Well, that was the other part. I thought the year was off. Yeah. 1665 is late.
It is late. This was a later wave.
Like the 1900s.
Yeah.
Talking about like 13th, 14th century when it was like, ugh.
But so, Steve, is there a definitive beginning to this, though?
Well, this is the only thing historically on the record of, yes, it has to be 6 feet. And it was in writing, so that's why it's historically.
Yeah, I mean, it probably predates, I don't know. Like, do you think that that's where all of the, like, the etymology of the phrase, like,
yes.
Six feet meaning death.
6 feet being associated with graves comes from this. That's
interesting.
Yeah, that's the thing. Okay. Item number two, the term mortician was invented by the funeral industry in 1895 to replace undertaker based on a contest in Embalmer's Monthly is awesome science.
God.
That is absolutely true.
Embalmer's
Monthly. I had to include it when I read that. Yeah, there was just a rebranding because the undertaker was too dark. And again, now they call themselves funeral directors is the more modern term, but mortician comes from that. It was just in a contest in a magazine. That's the one that they chose.
Think about how psyched that person was that they picked their word.
Yeah. Oh, God, and that, of course, is where Morticia Adams gets her name.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
But yeah, this is kind of a part of life, you know, that we all are familiar with, you know, and yet there's a lot of details about it that you may not know. You know?
Oh, there's like so anything. Much stuff that people don't know. And that's what a lot of predatory funeral
practices. Oh, the whole funeral?
And they prey on you because you don't know anything.
Gosh. And you're not thinking straight because your loved one just died.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, you need worst this. Time to make a bunch of decisions. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right.
For me, it's the expense of just like this ornate, beautifully crafted, high quality wooden coffin that's going to be 4 feet under the ground and never seen again. Like, are you kidding? I'm telling you guys, bury me in cool cardboard.
Well, that's the ludicrousness of like it being basically hermetically sealed.
That's ridiculous.
Like, it's ridiculous.
That's a total scam.
That's the thing that like when I talk to – I'm glad you brought her up, Evan. When I talk to Caitlin Doty quite a bit about this and about sort of these are the things that you should know, the things that you probably don't know. One of the things that her nonprofit funerary practice does is help educate people on how you can have a funeral for $1,000 or less.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because if you cremate, there are ways to cremate. There are ways, like all of these things that you can do yourself that people don't realize you can do yourself. You can have a wake in your home. You can transport the body yourself. There are all these things that you can do, but people think, oh my God, somebody died. I have to call the authorities immediately or I'm going to get in trouble.
Yeah.
And like, they just don't know what their rights are.
In most states, you do not need to even involve a funeral director.
And yeah, you can get a death certificate. Wow. There's a lot of different ways to get a death certificate. And like, yeah, she shows you how you can do a very beautiful service at home and then a cremation without any bells and whistles for about $1,000.
Yeah.
People don't like thinking about it, generally speaking.
Right. But some people I mean, I work with people who think about it all the time, right? Because I work with people who are like planning their deaths and who do medical aid in dying. And I think it's really cool to see how people who pre-plan this stuff, you know, really think about their loved ones and how to reduce the burden on their loved ones.
Yeah,
and leave very specific instructions on, you know, what kind of party to have. And it's kind of cool. I don't know. Love it.
So by the way, about Lincoln, the reason why he was embalmed was because the body had to be transported from Washington to Illinois.
Well, that's the reason that embalming started.
Yeah, because people had to be sent home.
Yes, and, because soldiers on the battlefield would die and they had to be shipped like multiple states away.
Yeah, which takes time. And he wasn't buried for 3 weeks after he died. So,
Well, you could wait a while when a body's embalmed.
Right.
Oh, and then there's the crazy story about the people who tried to steal his body. That's a whole other thing, but that really happened too.
Well, I didn't know
tried
that.
To break into. Yeah, they tried to break into his catacomb or whatever you call
not
it.
Not surprised.
Mausoleum.
Mausoleum.
Yeah.
Almost got away with it too.
His autopsy was botched. Did you know that they would sound the bullet? They would basically take a rod, go through the bullet hole to see how deep it was, right, until they hit the bullet. And the guy actually made a new track through the brain because he didn't follow
brain's
the hole.
Brain's pretty
squishy. Yeah.
Oh gosh.
And anyway, it was awesome. Of course, this all relates to the fact that for like 20 years following Lincoln's death, there were all sorts of conspiracy theories. How it wasn't a lone gunman; it was a conspiracy. Like it was just like with JFK. Mm-hmm. And then they had there were anomalies with the autopsy and with this and with that. You know, how did the did Wilkes Booth apparently get up there with a gun and everything? It's just that, powerful guy dies. There's going to be conspiracy theories.
Well, murdered, yeah.
All right, Evan, do you have a quote for tonight?
I do, and Craig Good provided this week's quote. Hello, Craig. It's nice to hear from you as always. Thank you for this. A reliable way to make people believe in falsehoods is frequent repetition, because familiarity is not easily distinguished from truth. Daniel Kahneman.
Mm-hmm. He was probably talking about the availability heuristic when he wrote that.
Hello. Yes.
Yeah. Familiarity makes people think something is true. Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Steve.
Yes.
Except for science or fiction. Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.